opinions conflict with what God has spoken through her authoritative voice. If our judgment does conflict, we assume it is our judgment that needs correction, not the church, which St. Paul calls the pillar and bulwark of the truth. I'm Mark Shea for CatholicExchange.com.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest this hour is one of my favorite people, Mary Beth Bonacci. She helped get the show Church and Culture started back in February of this year, and she's back with us today to have some more fun conversation. Mary Beth, thank you for joining us from Denver.
Oh, Deal, thank you so much for inviting me.
And I want to remind our listeners, probably already know your name and a little bit about you, but in your career as a Catholic apologist, you have been one of the leading spokeswomen for the life of a Catholic woman, its ups and its downs, its struggles with chastity, its struggles with the new sexuality, the new feminism. And, you know, you've given a number of major speeches, including one in Monterey to 10,000 kids, but you spoke to 75,000 out there in Denver back during World Youth Day when Archbishop Chaput was there.
Mm-hmm.
But your book, We're on a Mission from God and Real Love, is really, I think, the thing you're best known for other than your delightful personality.
Oh, bless you.
You went to the University of San Francisco, the Ignatius Institute, and you got a master's in theology of marriage and family from the John Paul II Institute. And Franciscan University was smart enough to give you an honorary PhD.
I'm telling you, it's the best way to get a PhD.
It is, actually. I can tell you that from experience.
You say thank you very much.
You know, we're in Advent, and we're getting close to the octave of Christmas holidays. And, you know, it's a time when many people have mixed feelings. I think they feel a lot of pressure to be happy, to sort of put it crudely.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's no secret that a lot of people suffer from a kind of sadness that is unexpected. And really is in some way, I think, connected to the expectations of the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And from your perspective, is that doubly true for single women who are joining their families without their husbands and children?
Triply. For those, to the extent that you buy in to what society expects, and I'm not just talking about getting married, but I just wrote an article about this for Catholic Match, my online column.
Yeah, and by the way, let's slow down and remind people how they can see your online column. Where can that be found?
At the Catholic Match Institute, catholicmatch.com. I believe it's catholicmatch.com/institute, or just go to catholicmatch.com and click on the Institute.
And we'll mention that again later at the end of the show. But what did you say in that article?
Well, I was talking about how I just gave away a bunch of clothes because my closet was...
You lost weight.
Again, no, bless you for that, too. let's go with that, sure. I gave away a lot of party clothes because I realized I had bought them not because I needed them, but because, like, I think I bought into if you build it, they will come. And the Christmas season especially, everybody talks about how, oh, we're so busy, it's such a busy season. And I think I'm really not that busy.
No. My wife and I, Teresa, have remarked how few Christmas parties we seem to be invited to compared to years past.
Yeah.
And we wonder, are people just not giving parties, or are we just being dropped off the list?
It's kind of always been my story, because when you're single, you've only got one. I worked for myself for years, and this party was, you know, me.
Right.
Then, you know, now I sell real estate, and my real estate office has a nice little party, but then I don't have a spouse to have a party. I don't have kids to have school activities. And when you don't run in kind of those married family active circles, you run more on the edges of them.
But you're very close to your family, your parents across the street.
I'm very blessed. And this is my Christmas is really, it's very full. It's just not that whirl of parties that the stereotype says I should be doing. And people get to, like, feeling bad about themselves. Like, this is, There's something wrong with me because I'm not going to all of these parties in this whirl of activity during the Christmas season.
Which is sort of the, you might say, the entertainment media version of what our wonderful life is supposed to be like.
Exactly.
And, of course, we need to remember that the famous Capra movie, It's a Wonderful Life, is filled with a great deal of darkness and begins with an attempted suicide. Exactly, more or less, what we're talking about, someone who at the holidays feels just overwhelmed by the burden of the expectations and that he, Jimmy Stewart, that is, can't meet them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And
how much unhappy? Ibsen said the essence of unhappiness is comparing yourself to others. Do you think that pretty true?
Exactly. And it's not even, and particularly in this Facebook age, it's not even comparing yourself to real others. It's comparing yourself, your reality, to others' facade.
Oh, let's talk about that.
Yes.
Because it's interesting what you get on Facebook, and it's interesting, and I'm an active user of Facebook, as you know.
I am as well. I see you there all the time.
And you're faced with issues about how do you present yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, most of my Facebook friends think I'm a professional golfer.
Oh, of course, because, yeah, it's there quite a bit.
Now, as a friend of mine, can you guess why I put up golf pictures the way I do?
Because it's your leisure and it's your joy. And
it's my great joy. Huh? Thank you. Thank you, Mary Beth. That's why, you know, you're my friend. I mean, and I think it's am I trying to show off? Well, maybe a little at 65. I can still swing a golf club. Okay, I admit it. It's out there. But on the other hand, I just get so excited at being out of doors, being alive, being healthy, out in a beautiful place with great people, because you never meet a bum on a golf course.
It's true.
That I just feel like sharing it. Just like I put up a lot of music, because I love my music. And I put up pictures of my, you know, my kids and my wife. I put up what I love.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a facade? Maybe.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, kind of yes and no. I mean, I do the same thing.
It's a facade because it only shows what I love, right?
Uh-huh. I mean, I when I'm having a bad day, when I'm struggling, I don't post because that feels like burdening people, and for that I go to the people I'm close to and I deal with it privately. But, yeah, I mean, I'll say right now, my Facebook, the portrait of me on Facebook is not a balanced portrait of my life. And if someone's...
Well, you're much prettier than that.
Oh, bless you.
I'm talking with Mary Beth Bonacci. We're talking about this curious mixture of social network, holiday blues, family relationships for single that women and married and so forth. So it's not a facade in the sense that we're trying to deceive.
No, no.
It's just that... If I have a really bad day, I don't take a picture of myself, you know, looking like a Dostoevskian, villain, and put it up there. Because I think Facebook should be a place where we basically support each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the very kind of terse little posts where people say they imply something's wrong but don't really say it. And then get everybody saying, what's the matter?
How do you hit the like button on something like that? I think they need another button for that.
Exactly, the condolences button or the...
Seriously, I have a hard time saying, hey, my mother died, we buried him. Like?
Yeah, like. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's the most popular social networking application in China is something called WeChat. It's huge. It's just monstrous. And of course, most Americans don't know about it. The only reason I know about it is because I went to China a few months ago. But they have not a like app. They have a love app. But click.
Uh-huh.
So if you get something you want to respond to, you respond with a heart. It doesn't say love, just a heart.
Uh huh. See, that's nice.
Which is some way more appropriate for what we're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Well, sure, because it's. And then you're expressing love for the person.
If Facebook could add that option.
Well, we have a chat with Zuckerberg.
Feeling
it over.
But we're not trying to deceive, but it's the same way. I mean, let's put it this way. Social networking is no different from just meeting a friend on the street, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How are you doing?
Fine.
Let me tell you about the miseries in my life. We don't do that.
No, no. And... But it's not that the people we love don't, we need to go to the people we love and share the things, but it's not with the same kind of flipped casual dumping that...
I find it very hard, even with the best of friends, though, to do that, to be perfectly honest.
I think a lot of us do.
And the thing is that it can get so dark inside my life. I mean, it can get so dark inside my mind. I mean, I think it's part because I read too much or I watch too many European films or something. But
you need some more, like, I Dream of Jeannie reruns.
Yeah, you just don't want to know where I am sometimes. And but what? I'll tell you something. I don't think I'm different from any other human being in that respect. None.
Oh, no.
Zero. You know, maybe I can call it existentialism, and they can't. That's the only difference.
Mm-hmm.
I have words for my darkness, which maybe helps me. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you feel the same reluctance?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because you know it seems like if you, when you go there, you just feel worse. And, I mean, there is a need to go there sometimes. There is a need to even though it is difficult, sometimes with some people. But, yeah,
well,
not just...
What happened to the Freudian insight about if you go there, you feel better?
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of denying that, or what?
There are times and places and ways where, in the end, sharing it... And, I mean, not that I want to give Freud any more credence than...
Well, Freud's a smart guy now. Come
on. Oh, yeah. He's just
like Nietzsche is a smart guy.
Sometimes a cigar just is a cigar.
That's right. Groucho is a smart guy, too.
Exactly.
Right.
And there's a guy I go to with my problem.
No kidding. And, you know, and that really is where I want to go with this conversation, and that is toward a, you know, we're at the holidays, we're in sacred time and heading toward sacred space. We talk about festivity, we talk about celebration of, you know, tree celebration, Eucharistic Mass, Nativity, so forth. Let's talk about play. Does play get harder as we get older?
Playing right. Well, I don't know if playing right's ever.
Just this feel, the sense. Now, we're going to start with the sort of common sense worth of sense meaning of play, like children play.
Yeah.
And then we're going to go drill down toward what theologians have called a kind of theology of play.
Yeah. It does. I mean, I think the guilt around play in this American culture of the Puritan work ethic, not that there's anything wrong with a good work ethic, but, you know, they say that play is the work of children, but I think in some ways play is the work of adults too.
Now let's go one step further, and I'm really following our mutual mentor in philosophy, the late Joseph Pieper.
Yes.
Who was for many people a great guide in learning Thomistic philosophy, because he wrote with such great ease. He was kind of the C.S. Lewis of Thomistic philosophy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In fact, he was a translator of C.S. Lewis into German. But he wrote a book, two books, one called In Tune with the World, A Theory of Festivity, which I've been reading this morning.
I hadn't read it
in 20 years.
I've never read that one.
And then Leisure, the Basis of Culture, which was his most famous book because it had a preface by no less than T.S. Eliot, which was published in German in 48, but came out in the early 50s in English, and has been around ever since, still in print. And he develops these themes of the ability to, you know, not work for certain, like on Sunday, to put away activity that has an end that isn't in itself. So his notion of play is developed around the idea of doing that, and this isn't a definition, it's just a general description, doing that which is an end in itself, which is also what contemplation is. So if there's an analogy between, say, the contemplation of a truth, which is an end in itself, and then playing, in which you're, of course, playing can become work, too, if all you care about is winning, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Is that what adults do with their play? Is they start?
Some do, and this is where, I mean, it's always interesting when families intermarry, because my family has always been very big on playing for playing's sake, and when we're together and we're playing, I mean, the goal, the object is to be together and to enjoy each other. And then people come into our family and whose goal is to win, you know, whether the card game or whatever.
Yeah, who's got the better looking car out in the driveway this year, right?
Or just the silly card game we're playing, you know, and my brother and I all just look at each other's hands and trade cards and get what we want, and they just go ballistic because it's winning and it's following the rules. Our goal here is to have fun.
Comparing what my children are doing and what college they're in.
Exactly.
Oh! Now, I think men don't go there as much. Men brag more about themselves.
Yeah.
Like
women is the one-off.
Right, like, I was in Scotland last month. You know, you like to drop that.
Yeah.
You know. And you don't even have to say anything else because they immediately go green within me, you know. It doesn't matter whether you won or lost. Just being there was winning.
Yeah, drop that one frequently.
So playing gets tougher when you grow old, but when you get really old, it becomes easier, and you and I are not there yet.
Oh, blah, yeah.
But, I mean, my observation is, really old, play kind of naturally comes back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just because you, why is that?
I don't know, because play is an end in itself, and by the time you get old, when the body starts to deteriorate, you can't.
You better give up all of these comparisons. The very thing that you've tortured yourself with all your life, you just can't keep up anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you? I mean...
No, you're generally forced to let... I mean, you can't compare your looks anymore because you lose them.
Let's face it. Okay, now, I just turned 65, as you know. And I know you just turned 39.
Yes, and some months.
There you go. But, you know... One thing, we don't necessarily compare ourselves to others. We sometimes go back and compare ourselves, like, did I look like that 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Now, fortunately, I'm so vain that I can still get in the clothes I wore 15 or 20 years ago. You know, that is no tribute to any great virtue on my part. It's just that I won't let myself look that bad, period. No matter what I, you know, no matter what... What is sliding which direction? I think, and I'm not sure if that's a sin or a virtue, but you can tort. I think for really beautiful women, for example, movie stars, celebrities, what they must go through at a point where they just simply can't, you know, make the impact on a room they walk into the way they used to.
It's a huge curse because when what you value yourself for in your prime is something so ephemeral and something that you're going to lose, when you lose it, you lose all sense of yourself. And I mean, and this is why God bless these poor women. They're doing every weird surgery and every desperate last-ditch attempt. And, you know, I just keep thinking I'd rather look old than weird.
You look great.
Oh, bless you.
But, you know, more importantly, you are great. And, you know, and I think that this is, the people that I have seen age successfully, you know, at some point, that you know, they talk about getting a kind of peace with themselves. They actually just say, you know what, it's kind of like the Fred Rogers moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I loved Fred Rogers. And whenever he would end his show, I'd get a little teary-eyed. Remember what he said at the end of the show?
Oh, what was it?
I like you just the way you are.
Just the way you are, yep.
Now, I don't want everybody who's listening to hate me because all of a sudden this philosopher, kind of lover of great books and art, has turned a sentimentalist. But, you know, I think that kind of, that's not sentimental, that's just good theology.
It's true, brought down to its most basic level for children. And, you know, this is something I tell my nieces and nephews all the time when they're getting to this point. I love you. Why do I love you? Do I love you because you're pretty? No. Do I love you because you're smart? You are pretty and smart. But I love you just because you're Audrey. And then she says, what if my name was Fred? Then
well, you know, I don't know if you will not remember this, but there was a Burt Reynolds movie in his prime when he was playing, you know, kind of, the roué, cad, unable to connect with a woman kind of thing. And there was a scene when he watched Fred Rogers end his show on TV, and he cried on film.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, what was the movie?
I don't remember, but if somebody does remember, I wish they'd email me and tell me. But I think that this ability to stand back and accept yourself for yourself, not to compare yourself with others or yourself in your past, mm-hmm. is analogous to this experience of play, because if you can't let go of those comparisons, how can you play?
Yeah.
How can you be festive?
You're dragged down. And so much of what passes for festivity is just exhausting, because it is that. It is that putting on the war paint and showing up to project an image to compare yourself to others or to boost yourself when they're comparing themselves to you. And it's not play. It's exhausting. It's not regenerating.
You're putting your finger on something. Why a lot of the, I just cringe at the idea of going to a lot of the cocktail parties in Washington.
Because
that's all they are.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing there about person to person friendship. It's like you say, it's putting on the war paint.
Yeah. And I remember when I lived there. I mean, I was young still, and I'm just from Colorado, where I'm like, hi, want to be my friend? And I was just so stunned that so much of what I thought, and I did make good friends when I lived there, most of whom were also transplants from elsewhere.
Right.
But how much of it was based on, well, are you useful to me? And if you aren't useful to me, then why would I spend time with you? And who are you to, you're right, it was very difficult to find that person to person. You have value, and let me get to know you and see what's interesting and fascinating about you, instead of how can you serve me.
You know, I'm wondering if perhaps as we grow older, we find it easier to find that kind of independent value in others. I mean, in other words, you know, I can look at you and say, okay, Mary Beth, regardless of that resume I just read, I think you're great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you didn't have that resume, you're great.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't really care about the resume.
Yeah.
Right? But I think it's hard, maybe it gets easier. Your first stage is you're able to do that for others even before you can do it for yourself.
Oh, far. I was just reading something yesterday about how with our possessions, about how we think if we give up all of our nice stuff, or if we stop striving for nice, constantly having nice stuff, that people won't like us. And then you stop and think, well, do I like others because of their nice stuff?
In fact, sometimes it just gets in the way.
Exactly.
And I must say that I'm a huge book collector and music collector and film collector, and my house is just overflowing with it. But like today, when I was getting ready for this interview, I was able to go and find books that I hadn't looked at in 30 years and just sat down and loved them.
Yeah. Well, that stuff gives you joy. And in the truest sense. It
took me back to my days when I visited the St. Ignatius Institute just before it was getting off the ground, where you ended up going to school.
Yeah, I did. And what a gift. That place changed my life by exposing me to the great works of Western civilization. Pieper. Thomas Aquinas.
Let's just give an advertisement shortly here for Joseph Pieper, because a lot of people, I mean, they know about C.S. Lewis. They know about G.K.
Mm-hmm.
Chesterton. They know about Hilaire Belloc. They know about maybe even Jacques Maritain. But Joseph Pieper was the German equivalent of Etienne Gilson, Jacques Maritain, and Mortimer Adler. He was a teacher at the University of Münster for 30 years, and he didn't die until the 90s. I remember I actually got to correspond with him.
Oh, wow, did you?
Yeah,
oh,
before he died, and because I was doing a lot of research. But a lot of his books were translated, and just to give you an example, his great book on St. Thomas Aquinas, called The Silence of St. Thomas, one of the best books ever written on happiness and contemplation. His probably his next most influential book, The Four Cardinal Virtues.
That was my favorite.
Yeah. Then a wonderful book on scholasticism and medieval philosophy. Then some books Ignatius picked up later on, Hope and History, an autobiography, which he wrote, and then I think an anthology, finally, that was published in 89. And, again, I go back to my description of him as sort of the one modern Thomas who writes like C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, yeah. He crossed the divide out of academia and could reach the average person like Lewis could, and in a way that a lot of philosophers just never get out of that rarefied air, and he did. And you could pick him up. And you know, I think this is why he was my favorite, because I went into the Institute at 20, and I mainly read Irma Bombeck. And, and so I was already a lover of Lewis.
Right.
But, and so to be exposed to all, it was great because it was a world I had never seen, and there was so much in it that I didn't think was, and there was a relevance to my life that I didn't think was. But some of these thinkers can cross it and touch you where you are better than others, and Pieper was one of them.
And he wrote about these kinds of things that a lot of philosophers don't touch upon: love, festivity, joy, leisure. He had a way of connecting with life in the everyday world, not just, you know, life in the academic world. I'm talking with Mary Beth Panacci from Denver. Mary Beth is well known for her work in the area of being a Catholic apologist for Catholic sexual morality, Catholic view of love and marriage, and just basically advising Catholic women about what they're going to go through as they struggle to live the faith as a young Catholic woman, single and then married. And Mary Beth, we're going to take a short break, and you're going to stay with us, and I hope that our listeners will stay with us, because we'll be back just after this short message.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
A man named John was sent from God to testify to the light, so that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but testified to it, and this is his testimony. His preaching created quite a stir, so the Jews from Jerusalem sent priests and Levites to ask him, "Who are you?" He admitted and denied, "I am not the Christ." So they asked, "Who are you then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." "Are you the prophet?" He answered, "No." So they said to him, "Who are you then, so we can give an answer to those who sent us? What do you have to say for yourself?" "I am the voice of one crying out in the desert, 'Make straight the way of the Lord,' as Isaiah the prophet said." Now some Pharisees were also sent to ask him, "Why do you baptize if you're not Christ or Elijah or the prophet?" And John answered them, "I baptize with water, but there's one among you whom you do not recognize, the one who's coming after me. I'm not worthy to untie the strap of his sandals." This all happened in Bethany across the Jordan, where John was baptizing. Now Jesus was anointed too. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring glad tidings to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, and to proclaim liberty to captives and release to the prisoners, to announce a year of favor to the Lord." It was more than a year. It was permanent. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
I'm back with Mary Beth Panacci. We're talking about theology of festivity, of play, of how to, as it were, survive the holidays and even actually succeed in celebrating the holidays in spite of many of the obstacles that we find put in our way both by ourselves and by the culture. Mary Beth, I was talking about Joseph Pieper, the great Thomistic philosopher, his book In Tune with the World, and I want to read you kind of his penultimate comment on the foundation of festivity, he actually quotes Friedrich Nietzsche, and he says, to have joy in anything, one must approve of everything. And here's how he explains that. He says, I mean the conviction that the prime festive occasion, which alone can ultimately justify all celebration, is at bottom to affirm everything that is good, and it is good to exist. Of course, he's quoting Aquinas there. For man cannot have the experience of receiving what is loved unless the world and existence as a whole represent something good and therefore beloved to him. So he's saying we can't experience festive joy, we can't celebrate unless there is this, within ourselves, this bottom line of affirming all that is good. That has to be there. That's a prerequisite.
Uh-huh.
Does that strike you as right?
Well, yeah. And, I mean, it seems counterintuitive in some ways, but then you think, how can you have joy if you're surrounded by what is not good?
Correct. In other words, if you try to focus, say, on just your child or mm-hmm. just your parents, yet the entire background of that vision is, in your view, desolation and disappointment.
Yeah. So there's a party.
doesn't that create, if not attention, a kind of complete subversion of what it is you're hoping to experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, doesn't all of our celebration in the end come down to God is good and God created us and everything God created is good?
So there's a foreground and a background.
Yeah.
You can't just find it in the foreground.
Yeah.
In other words, there's, you know, and if you just try to find it in the foreground, the background, the darkness of the background will just, it'll finally just undo you.
I have this vision of the cartoons where they're all of the dark eyeballs, like, peeking around at them, like, you know, I don't know, Flintstones or whatever in a scary scene when, yeah, the background is just all, like, dark and intruding. And, yeah, it's kind of reminding me of Chesterton's line about how the difference between hope and optimism is just a matter of optics and what you're looking at. And, yeah, you can't, if you're just looking at the foreground, but you know in the back of your head that the background is dark, you don't accept the background, the background isn't good, the big picture is bad. It's playing games with your head, which is, gets to, and I don't know, this may be a tangent, but so much of what passes for philosophy today is these kind of ideas of the universe and of affirmations and of telling yourself things are lies so that your brain will believe them and you can live in kind of this little happy world of your head and not in the real world.
You know, it may be that the sadness that some people at least experience when they hit the Christmas season or the holiday season is that the things that are in the foreground, the trees, the creches, the shopping malls filled with lights and the music, they're not enough.
No.
Because the background, this background that Pieper talks about, this fundamental affirmation of mm-hmm. that life is good,
mm-hmm.
is something that they haven't dealt with or that they've forgotten about, we've forgotten about.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be enough, and so when we're told that it's enough, and so when it's not enough, it puts pressure on, and it makes it even more keen.
Yeah, I mean, and in a way, I mean, you know, I was at, I made the mistake of going to a mall yesterday looking, for, and I just, I must say, I love being, you know, in a busy shopping mall at Christmas with the music and the people, usually. But there was something about it that hit me yesterday as just feeling just, I wanted just to run out screaming. Uh-huh. It just felt completely almost decadent to me.
Now,
that was a mood I was in. But on the other hand, it was a reminder that it is what I was experiencing. There was all this foreground, which can, at least for a time, serve to cover this more fundamental understanding of festivity and the source of joy that Pieper is talking about, that St. Thomas talks about, that Scripture talks about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking of, I remember when my sister was young and she went on a date, and it was the perfect date. It was the horse-drawn carriage and the roses and everything, but she couldn't stand the guy. And so you've got the props are perfect, but the essence isn't there. The props fall flat. It's you need the bigger picture. And if we don't see it, then the things that are supposed to make us happy don't.
Now, this leads to something that Pieper brings up in his book on festivity, where he criticizes those who say that ritualized forms of festivity, Mass, for example,
mm-hmm.
Those who say this kind of ritualized forms of festivity are fake and get in the way of true celebration. He says, to give up on ritualized celebration is the fastest way to lose the festivity altogether. Do you think there's a connection between the two points?
Oh, absolutely.
How would you see that? How would you explain that?
We threw away all ritual. We attempted to in the 60s and started from scratch with everything. And you lose. It's a contradiction. It's a paradox. But you lose freedom when you lose that structure. When you lose the ritualized structure of this, then you're back to the drawing board. You're back to reinventing it everything yourself. It's not.
Well, it's a reminder that we're temporal beings. In other words, there's ritual requires us to affirm again and again. We repeat the affirmation, repeat mm-hmm. the creed, repeat the prayers, repeat the supplications, and so forth. We aren't once and for all people who can sort of have a vision at, say, age 30, which will feed us the rest of our lives.
Thank God.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in other words, it has to be fed and it has to be replenished. And is what the liturgy doing? Is it a regular reminder that we have to begin our celebration, our sense of festivity at this most fundamental level, rather than going straight for the tree in the presence?
Exactly. There's a process, and it follows what we need as humans, but what we don't always remember, because we want to be like children and go straight for the tree in the presence.
What do you think in terms of the point Pieper makes in this? He says that, you know, that some Catholics will say, for example, even if there is no excitement or great singing in a church at Christmas, if everyone's just dull and dead, it's still Christmas. Now, he says that is simply wrong. In other words, you try to sort of ignore the lack of spiritual intensity in a congregation by answering with the objectivity of the incarnation and the objectivity of the fact of Christmas is, he says, simply to ignore the human reality of what should be present that isn't present.
Yeah, because then you've got the structure, but you don't have that which fills it. The structure is there to lead us to that enthusiasm, to that realization, to that human encounter, and if it's not there, you've just got a dead—you've got an empty building, you've got a dead structure.
Yeah, I mean, I think you and I have discussed this before, but I can't tell you how many times I have, either in a column or in a speech, really urged people to take more seriously the responsive side of the liturgical act of the singing and the responsories and so forth, which are often so listless, only to be told that I was missing the objectivity of the truth that was being presented.
Yeah, and I don't, I mean, yeah, the truth is being presented, but where's our response to it? Where's our, is it touching us? Is it reaching us? It's just still out there until we, and it's so hard for us as Catholics because, you know, we did grow up, it becomes rote. And it,
yeah, I mean,
it,
people are saying that the whole idea of a festival is that it's a human reality. In other words, it's not just a date on a calendar.
Yeah.
It's not just a brand name. That if it's a human reality, it should evoke some sign of human appropriate response.
Yeah, it's that's the indication that it's actually touching us and reaching us. Otherwise, it's out there, but we're still over here. We're not connecting with it.
I remember a few years ago, I won't name the parish I went to, but I took my then much younger son and then still in high school daughter to a service at Advent where I was, you know, really hoping to sing some carols because I think we were at a time when my son finally was at the age where he could learn, you know, some Christmas carols since he was, you know, not from this country.
Mm-hmm.
And during, you know, no one was singing except for me. I mean, I'm literally. And, you know, at the end of, I think, A Little Town of Bethlehem, when I was the only one who had sung, you know, you know, my family's not the type, they won't sing if no one else is singing, but I will. I'm just stubborn, right? And I'm a little bit deaf, so I reached over and whispered to my wife, I can't believe that nobody's singing. Well, evidently, that went all over the church.
Oh, no.
I mean, you know, everybody heard it, including the priest. But what do you find? I mean, I'm here in Northern Virginia, and you know, it's much better than it was in other places I live. But what do you find in terms of in Denver at the parishes you attend?
Yeah, it's a very mixed. It's a mixed bag. I mean, the church here has come a long way under the blessing of Archbishop Chaput and before him, now Cardinal Stafford. So you get parishes that are very dynamic, where it's really an experience, and then you get the kind of quieter, deader. I attended a parish in Arizona years ago, and again I won't give the name, but you know there were a few places liturgically they needed some tuning, but in terms of full conscious active participation, it was incredible. It really leads you to God. It leads you to connecting with God in you, because I mean it's theology of the body. We are
right.
We aren't, our souls aren't separate from our bodies. They're connected, and they are, we're embodied soul and soul bodies, take your pick. And so this stuff has to be mediated through the body. It has to be mediated through experience. And not that our feelings are going to be reliable at every moment, but our participation, our activity, what we do matters. And how we do it matters. And it matters in the relationship with God, because...
Well, it's almost like saying that, you know, you can say to your kids, look, it doesn't matter whether I show you love. I'm your parent.
Yeah.
And since I'm defining myself to you as your parent, I love you whether or not you can tell or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And let me kind of throw you a curveball. Pieper goes further in this book on festivity called In Tune with the World. He said, but let's remember that many of the great festivals, not just in Christianity but in other traditions, are connected with death. You know, they're not necessarily connected with things that are so-called happy things or joyful things. Or maybe that's the point. The word joy doesn't necessarily mean connected something with something that's traditionally known as happy.
Yeah.
Because aren't we expected to have some sort of joy at the moment in which we say goodbye to people who are passing along to God.
Yeah.
I mean, and so how do we integrate this notion of festivity, which is not just this kind of bland, easy celebration of that which is Christmassy. I mean, look at Easter. Easter's a festival.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a festival that contains the crucifixion.
Yeah, and it's back to what Heber said about acknowledging that all things are good, which, you know, comes back around to Romans, and all things come to good for those who love him. But it's, Heber said in the Leader of the Basis of Culture that leader is contemplation, accepting, seeing things as they are, and which means seeing even death as it is, which is our hope in Christ, which is a gateway to another world. So it's not like in a funeral, you know, where it's not the same, there's a funeral, it's not the same joy of, you know, woohoo, yay, like we were talking about liking on Facebook, you know, your mother died. But there's an appropriate, much more somber, but still festive, in our hope in the resurrection. So, you know, festivity isn't just optics. It's not just looking at what we want to look at and ignoring all the other stuff, but reacting appropriately and with ritual to everything, to everything about life, including death. And yeah.
Yeah, and maybe that's what rituals force us to do, not just to pick and choose.
Yes.
Now, and you also have to remember, you know, I mentioned that Good Friday is a part of Easter. Well, part of the Christmas narrative is Herod's slaughter of the innocents.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you talk about the darkest of tragedies being integrated or woven into the incredible moment of at the manger with the angels singing and the Magi arriving. And yet, the gospel writers thought it important to continue that narrative with Herod's search for the Christ child and his fear of the Christ child's power that he would wield against Herod's power and the power of all those who are like Herod.
Mm-hmm.
And back when I was a young man and a youth minister in a Baptist church, I decided that on Christmas Eve I would mount a production of the medieval Herod play, which was part of the cycle of religious dramas done in the middle and late Middle Ages around Europe. And the Herod play was one of the most popular because Herod got to, you know, run around the stage being bloodthirsty and yelling and screaming and, you know, acting out. But part of that play is the slaughter and the wailing of the women and the grief they show. And on this, you know, on this in this Baptist church in Atlanta, I had set it up so that when the knives went into the children, the women pulled out scarlet colored silk scarves.
Uh-huh.
And it looked like blood was, you know, flying around the stage.
Uh-huh.
And that one, and it ends with Herod screaming into the dark that, you know, he's going to hunt down Christ child and make sure that Christ child never is allowed to live. Well, as I stood at the door and my Baptist congregants came out the door, they all kind of looked at me and just barely could shake my hand. And one lady, if I said, why did you do that to us during Christmas?
That went over, yeah.
I was not the most popular guy around that church for a long time. But this is an example of the way in which, you know, we're reminded that our joy in life is not just a joy in that which we find easy to embrace,
mm-hmm.
and which involves no sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It won't be joy because it's going to be constantly overshadowed if we're not if we're not facing the other and incorporating it in, it's just escapism.
And again, going back to where we began the conversation, is it because we don't want to admit in our lives that there's going to be finitude, that there's going to be loss, that there's going to be lack of success, there's going to be failure, there's going to be there's simply going to be, as Cardinal Newman called it, the constant cycle of loss and gain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're no good at facing the dark side, and we need to.
And, you know, and of course, the thing about holidays is that they're annual, and they come around again and again. I mean, you know, you get through one, and then you're off on the liturgical year all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're constantly being trained to deal with this narrative, which involves life, death, you know, resurrection, suffering, and again, not just the suffering of the children that Herod killed or the suffering of Christ, but the suffering of the church itself, the disciples, and the martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, when you become a Catholic, you enter into a pretty bloody battlefield.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But you know, it's still happening today. I mean, ISIS is doing what Herod did. And
yeah.
We want to, it's so awful and it's so hard to, we just want to not think about it and it's over there and plug our ears and hum and have our Christmas parties. But it's nothing new. And that's what all of this shows us, is that this is the world. It's not just now, it's all along. And this is, you know, Pieper talks about how philosophy is the handmaid of theology, and I'm a theologian, so I always keep going back to the theology. But without knowing that there's a God who redeems all of this, it is just Sartre. It is just existentialism. It is just you try to tolerate it, and it's there, but what are you going to do about it? Without a God who redeems it, how can you look at it unblinkingly? You can't. You need the ultimate background, which is, it's all good in the end. He sees it all. He incorporates it all. This beautiful Christmas picture, there's genocide, there's feticide, there's, what is that, childicide.
Infanticide.
Infanticide.
Right.
You
ran short of your sides there. But when you think about Christmas, then, is the incarnation itself is an act in which God says to us, look, your world is has fallen. Your world is filled with sin and death and all the things that follow from that. But I am going to come into it and live among you, and I am going to allow all of that to put me to death. That I am going to allow myself to be a part of that, and by becoming a part of that, redeem it,
mm-hmm.
and lift it up, you know, and make life something once again we can celebrate, we can affirm, in spite of the fact that our life is lived, you know, constantly in the shadow of death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is.
So, If you were to come to me at the end of this show and say, Deal, what is it that we really are trying to say to those who are listening? You know, what? How would you summarize it?
I mean, really, on the Mr. Rogers most basic level, is you got to take it all. You can't just. We can't have joy. It's back to what Pieper said. We can't have joy if we're not acknowledging that all is good. If we're not taking in the whole picture and acknowledging the whole picture and That's the context in which our celebration happens.
And that's precisely the message of the Incarnation and Christmas. Mm-hmm. And Mary Beth Bonatti, thank you for being my guest once again on Church and Culture, and I hope you will come back.
Thank you, Deal Hudson. I would be happy to.
And Merry Christmas.
And to you, too, and your family.
And to all of you who are listening, please join us again this time next week for Church and Culture.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. St. Albert the Great Parish in Dearborn Heights invites you to the Infant of Prague Triduum, January 10th through the 12th. Father Ben Ludke will conduct this three-day devotion to the Infant of Prague, which will include Mass each day with special homilies, benediction, rosary, and more. For further details, call 313-770-3203. Join Ave Maria radio host Al Cresta on Wednesday, January 14th at St. Patrick's Church in Brighton. Nearing the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, Al will be discussing the aftermath of legalized abortion and what we can do to affect change. A Q&A session will follow his presentation. Call 661-805-3655 for more information. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, during the two Sundays before Christmas, we look into the family heritage of Christ, which also becomes our own family heritage, in which God works in mysterious ways.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk. Hey, dads, would you like your kids to own your Catholic faith when they grow up? Well, guess what? You have a lot to do with whether or not that happens. New research published in the book Faith and Family from Oxford University Press observes that the presence of a prayerful, affectionate dad who's actively involved in the life of his family is the single most important predictor of whether or not the children will grow up to be faithful. By all means, we dads should teach our kids how to pray and worship, and we should fill their minds with the facts of the faith. But we also have to show our children how to open their hearts to the faith, and we do that by opening up our hearts to our kids and letting God's love pour out. The best catechism might just be dad's willingness to be a hugger, to spend one-on-one time with our kids, and to be willing to really listen when they want to talk. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
College isn't just about academics. It's about a masterclass in dealing with other people. Join us now on Homeschool Heartbeat as Diane Coomer helps you prepare your child to handle relationships in college.
Diane, what kind of relational preparation can parents give their teens who are going off to college?
Young adults will need to relate to professors, other students, employers if they have part-time jobs, also to resident assistants if they live in the dorms, or possibly to landlords if they live off campus. Teaching respect for authority, how to make an appeal, how to disagree in a gracious manner with those who have opposing views, and how to honor and respect members of the opposite sex should be teaching and training goals during the high school years.
What about the challenge of balancing their social life with their schoolwork?
Mike, now you're talking time management, a skill that none of us ever outgrows. Set up a regular time at the beginning of the week to discuss items that appear on your teen's calendar. Lead them in mapping out a